Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Stephen Sewer, and I chair the LGBT Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. This evening, the Commonwealth Club is delighted to present Dr. Marcus Conant. Dr. Conant began his medical career in the city at the University of California, San Francisco, specializing in dermatology. In 1981, Dr. Conant began to see otherwise healthy gay men who had developed Kaposi sarcoma, cancerous lesions that present as purple patches under the skin. In the months that followed, Dr. Conant started a dermatology clinic to treat the growing number of patients suffering from the dreaded gay cancer. His early research on Kaposi sarcoma contributed to the discovery of the AIDS virus, and his research and advocacy in the early days of the AIDS epidemic are chronicled in Randy Schilt's best-selling book, And the Man Played On. In 1982, in collaboration with Frank Jacobson and Richard Keller, Dr. Conant started the organization that became the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, a groundbreaking AIDS services organization that has become a national model. In 1989, Dr. Conant established the Conant Medical Group, which quickly became the largest private AIDS clinic in the Western United States and one of the largest in the world. He has conducted critical research on protease inhibitors, herpes simplex, medical marijuana, and the transmission and diagnosis of HIV infection. Dr. Conant has served in a number of leadership roles supporting HIV/AIDS treatment and advocacy. He served as chairman of the California AIDS Task Force and co-chaired the California Leadership Committee. Dr. Conant has been honored with the Chancellor's Award for Public Service from the University of California, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation's Leadership Award, and the Practitioner of the Year Award from the American Academy of Dermatology. Last year, Dr. Conant was invited to serve as Chief Medical Officer for Presidio Pharmaceuticals, where he is working on a promising new AIDS drug and conducting DNA virus research. Tonight, Dr. Conant will be discussing the future of the AIDS epidemic. Please welcome Marcus Conant.
Thank you, Stephen, and my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me tonight, and my thanks to so many of my friends for coming as well. It gives me an opportunity to talk about a subject that is very dear to my heart, and that is the future of the AIDS epidemic, not worldwide, but the future of the AIDS epidemic in America. When the epidemic began 27 years ago, you could hardly pick up a copy of a newspaper without reading an article about AIDS in this city, AIDS in the United States, AIDS in America. You hardly ever see that anymore. You read about AIDS in Africa, AIDS in India, AIDS in China, and all of those are important. But let me remind you that we have 50 to 60,000 new infections of HIV a year in this country. So let's pick a number out of there. Let's say 57,000 new infections a year. And we've had that ever since the introduction of highly active antiretroviral therapy in 1996. So 50,000 times 11 years, 600,000 young men and women have been infected with HIV. 57,000 is also an important number. That's the total number of people killed in Vietnam through all the years of that war. And yet we get that many new infections with HIV in the United States every year. As a matter of fact, tonight in San Francisco, three young men will become infected who were not infected yesterday. We have between 800 and 1,000 new infections a year. Now, Americans are very much taken with proselytizing what we do in this country to others, perhaps because we're proud of what we do, perhaps a certain amount of hubris, but we spend a lot of time telling the rest of the world what they should do with respect for law, what they should do with democracy, even though at times we could look to our own backyard. And we tell the rest of the world what they should do about AIDS. The Bush administration's policy is ABC, abstinence, be faithful, and finally, if you must have sex, use condoms. And yet, abstinence doesn't happen in America. Sex begins at 14. Who are we kidding? And be faithful? The average number of marriages in America for a male is three. Three marriages. And if you doubt that, figures for all of this information I'm going to give you are on the Conant Foundation website. And those are CDC figures. The average number of divorces and remarriages for men in this country is 3.4 a year. And do we really believe that people are faithful until they get a divorce and then they find a new partner to start having sex with? No. So being faithful is not an American tradition. And condom use? Condoms are distributed, but not by the federal government. As a matter of fact, the federal government wouldn't touch it. They give money to community-based organizations who in turn can distribute the condoms. But the federal government is opposed to coming out one way or the other in favor of condom distribution. So we tend to proselytize our values to the rest of the world and tell them what they should do. And what I'd like to do in the 40 minutes or so that we have together is talk to you about what we should do here at home. There's a story told that a member of parliament in the early 1800s said he was sick and tired of these Americans coming over there talking to him about freedom. You know, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, freedom for everything, freedom for everybody in the United States, freedom to elect their representatives. And he was tired of it because one out of every five Americans was a black slave in bondage. And that's true. So maybe before we start telling the rest of the world what to do about AIDS, maybe we ought to try to do something to stop those 57,000 infections in the United States. Now, I'm going to try to structure this talk in three phases. The first will be, what was the first quarter century like? And particularly answer the question, why did we not have a heterosexual AIDS epidemic during the first 25 years of this epidemic? The second question is, where are we now? What's going on right now? And does that portend to a heterosexual epidemic in the next 25 years? And the final question, of course, would be, if it does, what is the AIDS epidemic going to look like a quarter century from now? Well, before we ask the question of why was there not a AIDS epidemic amongst heterosexuals in this country in the first 25 years, let's review what happened. The AIDS epidemic began in 1981. At least that's when we recognized the epidemic. The epidemic, we now know that there were cases as early as 87, 88 in the United States, but 77, 78 in the United States. But in 1981, the disease was recognized. And it was particularly seen in intravenous drug users, both in the straight and the gay community, and a lot of cases in the gay community. Now, it didn't expand in the heterosexual community, but it did expand tremendously in the gay community. So it probably came in from IV drug use and then found itself fertile ground where it could expand as you know that it did. And if you want to visualize the expansion of the epidemic, think of an airplane taking off from your local airport. And it rises into the sky and it's a trajectory straight up as far as you can see. And that's exactly what we've seen over the last 27 years, with most of the cases being gay men, intravenous drug users, a few people infected from transfusion, a few children from women who were infected from their IV drug-using partners, hemophiliacs, and a few Haitian immigrants. But that's what the epidemic looked like. But those figures don't really tell you exactly what it looks like, because today, 40% of all the AIDS patients are black, even though black people only make up 17% of the population. And 20% of the AIDS patients are Hispanic, even though Hispanics only make up 13% of the population. And so the epidemic is right, really an epidemic of Americans. It's an epidemic of black and Hispanic Americans, gay Americans, and IV drug users. Now, why was there a heterosexual epidemic in Africa? Because we have to ask ourselves that question first if we're going to ask why we didn't have one here. We know that the epidemic in Africa is a heterosexual epidemic, that countries like Tanzania, the life expectancy has fallen from 72 years down to 50 years and is falling. Why did that happen? Well, one of the reasons is circumcision. And three good, excellent studies have now shown that a man's chance of contracting HIV is reduced by 60% if he is circumcised, probably because of ulcerative disease under the prepuce. Herpes, chancroid, syphilis probably predisposes him. There's debate about exactly what the reason is, but it's probably genital ulcer disease. Unfortunately, the reciprocal is not true. Being circumcised does not protect his uninfected female partner. He will disseminate the disease as easily to his female partner if he is circumcised or not. Circumcision in the United States is extremely common in Caucasians, 85%, and these are CDC figures. It's only 60% in blacks and about the same percentage in Hispanics, and of course, far less common in recent immigrants to the United States. So circumcision was a factor in Africa for sure, but the real factor were multiple sexual partners. In the areas where AIDS epidemic is prevalent, a man may have a wife, a minor wife, girlfriends, prostitutes, barmaids. It is estimated that the average African man, where the epidemic is rampant, has 25 sexual partners a year. The average American heterosexual has 25 different sexual partners in a lifetime. 25 a year versus 25 in a lifetime. Now, early on in the epidemic, it was argued that this was going to be a disease of the receptive partner, the receptive gay male, the woman, that men were probably not at risk, and circumcised men were even lower risk. Well, some studies out of Africa in the early 80s gave lie to that assertion. The epidemiologists noticed that if you went and looked along the great Trans-African Highway, which goes all the way from the Congo, which in those days was called Zaire, through the top of Uganda and the Central African Republic, and ends in Kenya and Tanzania, they found that the clusters of AIDS were at the truck stops. And when they investigated those cases, they found that the truckers coming out of the Congo were HIV positive, and they would stop at the truck stops and have sex with the barmaids. And the barmaids would then go home and have sex with their husbands or lovers or boyfriends. And then those men would have sex with other women in the village who had nothing to do with truckers at all. And what does that prove? Men, the truckers, transmitted to women, the barmaids, who in turn transmitted to their boyfriends, female to male transmission, and those men then transmitted to other women. And that epidemiological study has been repeated both in Latin America, a study with truckers out of Brazil into Chile, and more recently in India, with exactly the same pattern. And for those of you that are fascinated by this, there's an article from 2000 by Stafford called Highway Cowboys, Old Hands, and Christian Truckers, showing that the behavior pattern of long-haul truckers in Florida is exactly the same as was seen in Africa. They stop overnight. The cute young guys go in and pick up the girls at the counter. The older truckers wait until the lot lizards, they're called, come up and knock on the truck window. And the lot lizards happen to be prostitutes who are supporting their habit with IV drug use. Now, why was there a homosexual epidemic here in the United States? Well, I think I've already given you the answer. It's exactly the reason that there's a heterosexual epidemic in Africa. Gay men in the late 70s, early 80s, and even until today, have multiple sexual partners simultaneously. They may be in a relationship. They may have a lover, but the two of them may go out together. They may go out separately. They may go to bathhouses. They may go to bars and pick up someone. They may have an old friend that they occasionally have sex with. But gay men, typically in this country, have multiple sexual partners at the same time, just like African men. And of course, that's why when the disease was introduced into the gay population, we saw this incredible augmentation. And remember also that in gay relationships, one or both of the partners have to be receptive, just like in a male-female relationship. But unlike many straight people believe, there's not always one top and one bottom. Often, people change roles. And in a relationship, one person may be the insertive partner and the other the receptive partner, and later in the same evening, roles are reversed, and the one who was the insertive partner is now the receptive partner. You've almost doubled the chance of transmitting the disease. Now, we know that transmission from males to females is more effective than transmission from females to males. I've told you about the experience with the Great Trans-African Highway, proving that it can happen, but what's the chance that it will happen? Well, Nancy Padian at Berkeley has done some beautiful work on this over the last 15 years, and she has shown that a woman's chance of contracting HIV from her infected male partner is 8 to 10 times greater than the male's chance of getting the disease from his infected female partner. So 8 to 10 times more likely if you are the receptive partner than if you are the insertive partner. Of course, if you play both roles, then, of course, your chances are equaled out. But like the odds in Vegas, those 8 to 10 odds are stacked against you, because once you get HIV, you've got it. Let me use a really simple example. If you have a coin that every time you flip it, it's weighted to come up tails, and it'll only come up heads one time out of 10, and you flip it 10 times, it's going to come up heads once, but at that time you now are infected with HIV, and game's over. You've caught the disease. There are no more flips allowed. And so consequently, if you have enough sex with enough infected people, even if you're the insertive partner, you finally get one chance for catching the disease. And the epidemiology in Africa proves that point. The number of women infected with the disease are about 60%. The number of men are about 40%. 60-40 approaching 50-50. What does that say? Transmission back and forth is approaching equality. Jim Curran, who was head of the CDC's Task Force on AIDS in 1985, when we've had the first international AIDS meeting, gave the following analogy. He said, if a gay man had come to San Francisco in 1980 and had sex with 100 different men, he would have been exposed to the HIV virus one time. If he came back to San Francisco in 1985 and had sex with 3 men, he would have been exposed one time. In other words, in that early 5 years, the disease spread at an incredible rate through this city. And that's when many of us were seeing the lymph node syndrome and Kaposi's sarcoma and the early cases of pneumocystis pneumonia. We estimate that as many as 17 men a day were catching the disease. And I had a discussion with a friend last night about, well, look how much better it is today. Today it's only 3 versus 17, but in my view, that's also unacceptable. We should get to a point where we can stop the transmission of this disease. We also know that HIV is far more infectious right after you get infected than it is the longer you go. Now, the longer you go without being treated, you still have a greater chance of infecting somebody. No one is saying, well, you know, just wait the first 6 months and then you can go back to doing whatever you want. But in that first 6 months to a year, you're far more infectious. And we know that from work that Margaret Fischel did in Florida, again in the early 80s, before we had the ELISA test for HIV. Margaret was looking at a group of Haitian women who had migrated to the greater Miami area. And she was looking at the pattern of HIV, AIDS, in the children. And these were Haitian women coming from Haiti. The first child had AIDS. The next 3 children didn't have AIDS. And the final child had AIDS. And why would that be? Well, she was, now we know, we didn't at that point. But now we clearly know. She was far more infectious when she first got infected, and that's when she got pregnant with her first child. Then as her immune system clicked in, it didn't eliminate the disease, but it suppressed the virus. It set the viral set point drop to a point that she was not as infectious. And so she delivered her next three children. They were not infected. And then as her body lost control of the virus and the viral load began to rise, and she was about to die, and she had her last child, that child got infected as well. So, of course, the time to find out that people are positive and to get them on treatment and to stop transmission is shortly after they get infected. And yet the three young men in San Francisco who get infected tonight may go months to years before they find out that they're infected. Remember, it is 10 years between the time of infection until the time you can make a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS. Now, if that's why we had an epidemic amongst heterosexuals in Africa and amongst homosexuals in the United States, why did we not have a heterosexual epidemic? Well, in the first place, there were very few women infected early in the epidemic. And you're not going to get straight men infected until you have women infected, because that's who straight men have sex with. And while straight men may occasionally have sex with a gay man, he will be the insertive partner. He will not be the receptive partner. And so a chance for a straight man to become infected with HIV was very, very low, unless he was an intravenous drug user. And we know that there's a much lower transmission from the receptive partner to the insertive partner than vice versa. A man is at much less risk than is a woman. And so you have to start having a large pool of infected women before you start seeing a heterosexual epidemic. And of course, as I've mentioned, 85% of Caucasians in this country are circumcised. So all of those things played into the fact that while the virus was there and in the straight community from IV drug use, it didn't take off. But the real reason that we have not seen the heterosexual epidemic yet is that American males, heterosexual males, tend to practice serial monogamy. They are with one partner for a while, they become sexual, they fall in love, they're together for a while. That relationship goes sour and they move on to another partner, they have sex, but they're having sex with just that partner most of the time. And then they move on to another partner. So while the African male is having 25 partners simultaneously, the American male has his 25 sexual partners over many, many years. And it's the serial monogamy, more than anything else, that explains the difference in epidemiology in this disease that we've seen over the last quarter century. So if that's what's happened, where are we now? Well, we now have 1.2 million cases of HIV. We've had over 600,000 deaths. More people have died of HIV/AIDS than died in the Civil War on both sides, the worst war in American history. And we have some 600,000 people infected with the disease living today. Now, of that 600,000, a third know they're positive and are on treatment. And that's good, because studies have shown that if you know you're positive, it's a great chance that you will be cautious, you'll use condoms, you'll practice safe sex, you'll take steps necessary to protect your sexual partner. Most people are responsible most of the time. And also, if you're on drugs, it reduces your viral load and makes you less infectious. And that's a good thing as well. Another third of the infected population know they're positive but are not on treatment. Now, part of that is because of federal guidelines for treatment, which recommends that everybody be treated if their viral load if their CD4 count drops below 350. It suggests that you could initiate antiretroviral therapy regardless of your CD4 count or your T-cell count, but people have to be ready for the drug. Now, I would predict that within a very short period of time, less than 2 or 3 years, we will see a recommendation that everyone who's HIV positive be put on drug as soon as they are discovered to be positive. The reason for the delay was financial, the side effects from the drugs, and the fear that people would blow through their treatments and you wouldn't have anything to treat them with. All of those have been put to rest. We now have 28 drugs for treating HIV. And before long, the recommendation is going to be, if you're positive, you should be on treatment. But right now, a third of the people who are positive are not on treatment. Now, some of them aren't on treatment because they don't want to be reminded they're positive. And some of them are not on treatment because they're IV drug users or whatever, and they just can't remember to get to the pharmacy to buy it. We still have 40 to 50,000 people in this country who have no access to health care. Where are they going to get their drugs from? And so you've got this large population of people who need drugs, who could use drugs, where we could reduce the viral load, who are not on drugs. But the scary figure is that of the third of the patients who are HIV positive, most of them don't know it. And so they're having sex tonight, assuming that they aren't at risk to anybody. I'll read you a figure from New York City 3 years ago. 77% of men who have sex with men in New York, ages 15 to 29, do not know that they are HIV positive. 77%. Now, why is it that they don't know they're positive? Well, who wants to think they're going to get a fatal disease? So there's not a whole lot of reason to run in and get tested. And if you're a kid living in Harlem, where are you going to go to get tested? You show up at an emergency room. You know, George Bush says everybody can get health care in America. You just show up in an emergency room. I suggest to you, show up in an emergency room tonight and tell them that you're there for an HIV test. And the nurse will say, son, I'm sorry, but we're really busy. And we don't have time to do routine health care here in this emergency room. And so they don't have access to care. Young people believe they're invincible. They're not going to catch this. This is a disease of people in their 30s and 40s, and I don't even want to live to be 40. Remember that? When you never thought you'd ever see 40 or 50? And yet, that's exactly how these kids are thinking. But it's even worse. As Stephen told you, I practice dermatology as well as HIV medicine. I can't tell you the number of cases that I've seen in my office across the street from the University of California, where the patient showed up in the emergency room that night with shingles, with zoster. And he says on the form, you know, see your local doctor the next day. So they come to see me the next day, and I say, yeah, he's right, you have shingles, and yeah, you're right, he put you on the right medicine. Did they ask your sex? And he says, yes, I filled out a form. They said, male or female. Did they find out if you were gay? No. Did they find out if you'd been tested for HIV? No. And here you have a 40-year-old man with shingles, a marker for HIV infection, and the doctor in the emergency room is not even suggesting that he have an HIV test. And this is in San Francisco, ground zero for the AIDS epidemic at the University of California Medical Center. Because doctors think, well, I can tell who's at risk, but, you know, I know what they look like. Right? You know? Doctors think, oh, he's the banker. He's got a couple of kids. He may go to New York every month for a week, but I'm sure that's on business. It may be business, but it's not banking business. The doctor thinks that, you know, I just can't believe that little Tommy, who I've known all of my life, could be HIV positive. And so consequently, the doctor doesn't order the test. But it's even worse than that. Many doctors don't want to know if the patient is HIV positive. The first place, they have to then know what to do about it. But even worse, you have to tell that person that they're HIV positive. And I can tell you from personal experience, if you're trying to see six patients an hour and you've got somebody sitting in room three about to lose it because you've told them they're HIV positive, that's going to ruin your day. So the easiest way to do it is just don't test them. Don't find out. And then you don't have to deal with the issue. And unfortunately, and I'm not condemning all doctors, but unfortunately, that's the paradigm. So who are these infected people? Well, as I've told you, a large percentage are black and Hispanic. In Mississippi, Alabama, and North Carolina, over the last 3 or 4 years, 30% of all of the new cases of HIV have been in black women. Now, I told you, you're not going to see a heterosexual epidemic until you have women infected. But now we have women infected. And who are these women? Black women, underprivileged women in the South. Let me read you some other figures, again from New York City, where the epidemiology is good. If you do the epidemiology here in San Francisco, the disease is mostly a disease of gay men. But in New York, 20% of all black men, not black men who have sex with men, but all black men ages 40 to 50 are HIV positive. 20%. 50% of all cases of HIV in New York are amongst black individuals, though they only make up 25% of the population. 34% of all of the cases of HIV in New York, new cases, are in black women, very much like I told you is happening in Mississippi, Alabama, and North Carolina. And 48% of all the teenage cases of HIV in New York are in black teenagers. A black woman in New York has a 27 times greater chance of contracting HIV than does her white sister. Now, were that not bad enough, there are a number of confounding variables that are going to make the epidemic in the next 25 years look even worse. Kids are now having sex beginning at age 14. Now, admittedly, it's usually oral sex first, but we read in the paper last week, 1/4 of all high school kids, all high school girls, will have a sexually transmitted disease before they finished high school. And if they're black, it's half of them. Now, if they're having sex and they're getting a sexually transmitted disease, they're at risk for getting HIV. Another major problem is that the churches won't touch it. When the AIDS epidemic began and I started what became the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, as Steve told you, we knew exactly what to do. We went to the gay bars and we went to the bathhouses and we gave lectures and we handed out brochures and we talked to people and we had bowls full of condoms at the end of the bars and we said, you know, have a good time, but take home a condom. And we educated people where they went to meet people. Well, where would black people go? The churches. And where do Hispanic people go? The Catholic churches. And yet the black ministers, by and large, will not touch this. They won't talk about it because of the shame, the stigma, the fact that it's homosexuality and adultery and IV drug use. And the Catholic Church says you shouldn't use a condom even if you know your partner's positive. So the two places that we could go to reach the people who are at risk are not available to us. And of course, the shame carries on even further. In the black community, men practice what they call on the down low, meaning they have sex with men, but they don't tell anybody about it. And in their culture, they have sex with women and often marry and often have children because they don't want to be stigmatized as gay. And if their grandmother wants a baby, they may get their wife or their girlfriend pregnant to produce that baby, again, without admitting to anyone that they're gay. Now, amongst Caucasians, white men have come out of the closet, but black and Hispanic men have not. The family social pressures are too great. And for that reason, there is greater transmission in those communities, the shame, the stigma of being gay, of being perceived as being one of those people. And there's one final confounding variable that's been added, and that's two new drugs. One of them is the erectile dysfunction drug, Viagra and Cialis, and the other, of course, is crystal methamphetamine, crystal meth, speed, Tina. 20 years ago, people were using drugs like alcohol, marijuana, heroin, cocaine to seduce and to have sex. Alcohol's been used for a long time as pre-foreplay drug, okay? I mean, Dom Perignon didn't invent that just because it bubbled, okay? Alcohol has been a drug that's been part of the sexual life of people for hundreds of years, and other drugs have as well. But on all of the drugs that I named, after you drink a little bit or take a little bit, you doze off, but not crystal meth. With crystal methamphetamine, you can have sex for hour after hour after hour. And when your prowess fails you, you can take a Viagra and go on for another few hours. I have patients who come in who started having sex on Friday night. Sometimes Saturday they take a Viagra, so they continue to have sex, and they have sex until sometime early Sunday morning. At that point they go home and they crash for a few hours, and then they get up and they have to go to work. Well, if you've been up for 70 hours and having sex, a good strong cup of coffee is not going to do it. So what do? You have another little bump of crystal meth. to get you through the day. And they do that for a day or two. They may take off Wednesday as sick, crash for 10 hours, but then there's Friday night again. And after a few weeks of that, they're hooked on crystal meth. And that's a huge problem, because not only does it allow them to continue to have sex over and over and over and forget the condom, but of course they're having sex in a way in which their judgment is impaired, and they're doing it in a way where they're going to transmit the disease, or they're going to catch the disease and not know they have it. So where is this epidemic going? Well, it's going to continue in gay men for a considerable period of time. They're going to remain close to half of the new cases, in my estimation, for the next 20 years or so. But it's going to spread more and more to the heterosexual population, but not the whole population. It's going to be blacks in the southeast, Hispanics in the southwest, and people doing crystal meth up and down the Mississippi corridor, where the drug is extremely prevalent. That's what it's going to look like. And that can be pretty well projected for the next 25 years, with no clue, no evidence that it's going to drop below the 50 to 60,000 new infections a year, and may grow even larger. Remember, the gay community only makes up 4% of the population. The other 96% are heterosexuals. And so if we get a heterosexual epidemic, the absolute numbers will rise to incredible levels. So what should we do? Well, let me make three suggestions in closing. The first is, yes, we need to keep up the education prevention programs. And the moment you see that we're doing some good, the funding cuts off. But God in his wisdom keeps making little gay boys, and you have to keep educating them year after year after year. What the guys learned 20 years ago is not applicable to the kids at the bars tonight. And so those education programs have to continue and be as intensive as they were back in the early 80s. But more than that, we should offer HIV testing to every person who goes to a draw station to have blood done for any reason whatsoever. A young girl that goes in for a pregnancy test should be tested for HIV. The young kid who goes into emergency room because he's been stabbed in the side with an ice pick should have a test for HIV. The guy who is a banker who has a kidney infection and has a blood test should be tested for HIV. And in the discussion period, we can talk about this. It can be done extremely cheaply. And who should pay for it? The insurance companies. It's cheaper for them to find out that someone is positive and treat them than to wait until they show up in an emergency room with pneumocystis. So we should be testing everyone in the culture at this point, regardless of whether we think they look like they're like that or not, and find out who's positive and offer early treatment. And the second suggestion is that the insurance companies should demand that a laboratory who finds that a patient has a detectable viral load have that reported either to the insurance company or to the state. Right now, if I order a test for syphilis and you go and have a syphilis test, the lab has to report that to the state. And the state comes to me and says, have you treated this guy for syphilis? Well, I think the same thing should be done with an HIV test, because we have enough drugs to get everyone's viral load undetectable. And yet I see patients on a regular basis who come in and you say, what's your CD4 count? 400. What's your viral load? 4,000. Why is it that high? Well, my doctor said it was 50,000, and 4,000 is pretty good, so we don't need to do anything. Well, if you know anything about virology, you know that, yeah, you keep it up and you'll be totally resistant to all the drugs you are currently taking. And that should be reported to someone who can go back to that doctor and say, why does this patient have a detectable viral load, and what do you plan to do about it, doctor? And working with the county medical societies, you could actually educate the doctors as well. So there are things we can do, but as Gore Vidal, in his usual wit, points out, planning is contrary to the American genius. So chances are we won't do it, and we'll see an epidemic like I suggested. So I began this talk by pointing out that a member of Parliament was critical of America because we talked so much about freedom and told everybody else what to do, and yet one in five Americans was a slave. And I will end it by reminding you that we run around the world telling everyone what they should do, and one out of every five black men in New York City is infected with HIV. Thank you.
You want to switch seats or do it?
Switch names.
Okay, good. There you go. I just need all my notes, please.
I tell you what, then switch seats.
Okay.
And your watch is there.
All right. Thank you for bearing with us. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Dr. Marcus Conant. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the LGBT Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for tonight's program. We're discussing the future of the AIDS epidemic, and I invite the audience to submit written questions on cards. So this Sunday, Dr. Conant, in the New York Times, there was an editorial titled "Grim Outlook for an AIDS Vaccine." In the piece, they suggest that there is no hopeful route to success outside of a biological equivalent of a Hail Mary pass, a wholly new approach that would combine gene therapy, stem cells, and immune therapy. Do you agree with this assessment, and how long will we have to wait?
Unfortunately, I do agree with it. I have been very involved with AIDS vaccine development. As a matter of fact, working with Senator John Vasconcellos, we got legislation passed in California in the 1980s to indemnify companies like Genentech if they got into the vaccine field, because companies were doing nothing because they were afraid of being sued. We see no hope for a vaccine at the present time. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible, because there are strategies that have not even been tried. For example, whole heat inactivated viral vaccines have not been fully explored. But from everything we know at this point, and from the trials that Don Francis and others have done, there is no hope for an HIV vaccine right now. Now, let me remind the audience, we don't have a vaccine that absolutely prevents tuberculosis. We don't have a vaccine that prevents syphilis. We don't have a vaccine that prevents malaria. It may not be possible to develop a vaccine for this disease. And so one would be naive to say, oh, well, another 10 years, like Tony Fauci does. We have no idea if we will ever see an effective HIV vaccine. But we do have effective ways of preventing the disease. I mean, condoms will work. The problem is that people aren't using condoms.
Thank you. You touched on another question. Outside of success with polio and HPV, what is the scientific track record in curing viruses?
Well, HPV, there is a vaccine, but it's one not being widely used and has to be used before the girl is exposed to the HPV, so at age 9. So we haven't seen the track record there. But polio is good. The real success story, of course, is smallpox, because we were able to actually eliminate smallpox as a disease. But the hopes for an HIV vaccine are very, very bleak.
Okay. You spoke a little bit about early drug treatment intervention. Does this affect clinical outcomes, and what is life expectancy of an HIV-positive person on active drug therapy?
Right. It certainly does, in fact, affect outcome. There's now ample data that the earlier someone gets on treatment, the greater their chances of surviving for a longer period of time. That was one of the reasons that early on women appeared to be dying at a faster rate than men, because they waited longer before they accessed care. That's why blacks tend to die at a greater rate than whites, again, because they do not have early access to care. So early treatment directly translates to longer survival. Now, to answer the second part of that question, what's the life expectancy? We don't know, because we've only had highly active antiretroviral therapy for 11 years. So we only have an 11-year track record. There is some concern that some of the drugs, particularly protease inhibitors, because they elevate cholesterol and triglyceride, may cause an increased incidence of heart disease. So it may be that treatment for the disease may, in fact, impinge on one's long-term survival. But we have patients now who've been on highly active antiretroviral therapy for 11 years, and they're back to normal weight, they're back to work, their CD4 counts are normal. For all intents and purpose, they're perfectly healthy.
In 1982, you started the Kaposi Sarcoma Research and Education Foundation, and as far as I can tell, this is one of the first AIDS services organizations ever. You've talked a little bit about that in your program, but
You also spoke about the explosion in the Black and Hispanic communities. Should these communities embrace the existing treatment infrastructure, or should they respond in their own communities the way you did?
I think they need to respond in their own communities. Again, you know, you don't do very well if you go tell other people what they should do. People do very well if they go and realize they have a problem and take care of it themselves in their own way. Now, those two communities can use us as resources for how to do it, but you don't just go and tell people what they have to do. My suggestions, for example, of testing people when they go in for blood, that needs to be debated in a legislature. That we can't impose that on a society because there are all sorts of questions: confidentiality, loss of insurance, discrimination. And so it should be debated in a legislative body and passed into law and then implemented. So I think we would be far more successful if we had Black leaders stepping forward and Hispanic leaders stepping forward and going to Black churches and going to Catholic churches and saying, we need to start educating people. One of the most interesting studies I read recently was a wonderful pilot project that had shown that education, if carried out by Black hairdressers in the South, was very effective. Because the hairdresser could talk to the woman while she was there and educate her about what she should tell her grandchildren and her children.
What is the latest research on transmission during oral sex?
Well, there is no good data. And your audience should understand this. The Centers for Disease Control came up with a pyramid way of determining, were you at risk for contracting HIV? And so when they would find someone that was positive, they would say, have you ever had receptive anal sex? Have you ever had receptive oral sex? Have you ever had a transfusion? Have you ever been to Haiti? Okay? And if you said you'd ever had receptive anal sex once, you were put into that category, and you were not counted as having contracted it from oral sex. And so we don't have any good figures on who got it from oral sex because of the way we set up the paradigm. Now, in my practice over the years, I have 12 patients who absolutely swear to me that they had contracted it from oral sex. They may have had receptive anal sex before, but it was long before the AIDS epidemic. And I have 12 patients out of, 5,000 patients we cared for, where I think it was transmitted by oral sex. So, yes, it can happen. It's probably very unlikely. But unfortunately, there are very few people who just have oral sex. That's usually a precursor to some other form of behavior.
Are HIV-positive people more susceptible to MRSA? And if so, what is the link? Is it simply the impaired immune system, or is there something more at work?
There's something more at work, and that's crystal meth and having sex for 70 hours. Remember that MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus infections, come from body contact. Well, if you're having sex for 70 hours, there's a lot of sweat and there's a lot of chance for transmission, and that's the factor with MRSA. So, yes, MRSA is common in the gay community, but it would be common in any community where there was a lot of body contact in that manner.
Circling back to the vaccine question, do you think we should give up on a vaccine and redirect those dollars to testing, treatment, and prevention?
Yes. I don't think we should totally give up. There's enough money. We're spending enough money in Iraq right now. Maybe we ought to divert a little of that to healthcare in this country. But there's enough money to continue vaccine research and development. But I think that diverting some of those funds right now to widespread testing and trying to find out who has a detectable viral load and treat those patients would be far more productive.
This person wants to know if there's anything more. He says, in San Francisco, we have an epidemic. Besides widespread testing and encouraging condom use, what else can be done to reduce the increase of new infections in gay men?
We need to go back to education as it was done in the 80s. It's still here, but it's not nearly as intense as it was. We were spending a tremendous amount of money in the early 80s. We need to popularize ads in the straight newspapers. We need to popularize ads at bus stops. We need to popularize ads in bars and venues where people gather. And we need to realize the co-factors. crystal meth is a huge problem in this community, and we have to address the crystal meth problem if we're going to fully conquer the HIV problem.
And along those lines, do you embrace more of the harm reduction approach?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And for those that don't understand, harm reduction means accepting that people will behave in a certain way and yet trying to prevent them from catching something even worse. A good example is needle exchange. Now, we have needle exchange here in San Francisco. I was in Australia when they initiated needle exchange in Australia. And the number of intravenous drug users in Australia infected with HIV is minuscule compared to the United States. And what year was that? 1983. And here we are in 2008, and we still do not have widespread needle exchange. Harm reduction says, we don't want you to be an IV drug user. We wish you weren't an IV drug user. We'll do everything we can to help you get off the drugs. But you don't have to die because of that. And unfortunately, many of our politicians say, until they give up the drugs, we can't do anything to help them. And it's a death sentence.
Is it true that during the Summer of Love, you volunteered at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic?
It is.
You have anything to tell us about that time?
Yeah, I learned a lot from that time. The one thing I actually, that started my interest in sexually transmitted diseases, because during that time, we saw the epidemic of genital herpes. And so here in the Haight, you had all these young people coming in with genital herpes. And I learned a lot. I mean, I was a little kid from the South, and I thought you had to get engaged before you could have sex. And these kids were coming in, and, you know, they all had herpes. And you'd say, well, who's your betrothed? And he'd say, well, my old lady's over here, and I had sex with him last night, and the three of us had a pile-up the night before. And I thought, oh, wow. So anyway, we got very interested in genital herpes. And I started a clinic at UC, just like I did for HIV, for genital herpes. But what I learned was that waiting until they get infected and come to your clinic with the disease is not enough because it's too late. And so when AIDS came along, literally one valley over from the Haight over to the Castro, that's why I said I've got to go out and do something like start the foundation and get involved with education and prevention, because it's not enough to have a clinic where somebody walks in and says, yes, you have a fatal, incurable disease, have a nice day. You know, it behooves you to get out there and try to stop the disease. And so what I learned was what then led to the engagement later on with trying to stop the epidemic.
With the extensive work of the Gates Foundation and the Clinton Foundation, the global initiatives, what role is left for governments of the developing world, the developed world?
Oh, well, the governments of the developed world can do a lot more. Again, if a vaccine is developed, it doesn't have to be developed in the United States. I mean, Britain, France, Germany have great vaccinologists as well. But a lot of the support for care is being given by the governments of those countries as well. Great Britain, for example, gives more money to Africa than we do. But the Gates Foundation, with all of its money, can't possibly conquer this epidemic. We're talking about, 45 million people infected with this virus. And so while the Gates Foundation is doing wonderful things, it's going to take all of us doing lots of work to try to even contain the AIDS epidemic. Right now, there are only 3 to 5 million people on drugs. You know, that means there are 40 million people, 45 million people who are HIV positive who are on no drugs. So there's plenty of work for everyone.
There are a number of questions here about transmission. Do you think you could just give us a brief sort of summary of how it's transmitted, what types of fluids?
Sure. Transmission is, HIV is a sexually transmitted bloodborne disease. And so seminal fluids, vaginal fluids, blood contain the virus in varying amounts. We know that if you're on treatment and you get an undetectable viral load, there is still measurable virus in semen, but it's at a very low level, much lower than in people who are untreated. But it is the exchange of fluids that is the risk factor. And so that's why sharing needles is a risk factor. Someone shooting drugs but using sterile needles that have been handed to him in a clinic may kill himself with the drugs, but he's not going to get HIV. Two people who are HIV negative sharing drugs are never going to get HIV unless one of them contracts the disease. Okay, so you have to share a needle with someone who is infected, and that's why many of us advocate a needle exchange program. The same is true with sex. Sex with a condom will prevent the exchange of fluids, and that will prevent or significantly reduce the chance of contracting the disease. Now, all of the clinicians in the audience have seen patients, as I have, who have used condoms and had sex with someone who's positive and have contracted the disease. So it's not 100% effective, but it is certainly the most effective thing we have, and it is extremely effective given the severity of the disease and the risk.
There are several political questions here. One, the questioner wants to know what role homophobia plays in U.S. AIDS policy today.
Still plays a huge role. For example, as I was thinking about this talk, you know, we say, well, the thing that makes the HIV epidemic different between the gay community and the straight community is serial monogamy. Well, serial monogamy comes because you have committed relationships, right? And then you move on from that relationship to another relationship. And yet, anytime you mention gay marriage, everybody goes absolutely nuts, because that's not encouraging commitment. That's encouraging promiscuity. So just the whole basic idea. And, of course, we still don't allow gays in the military in this country. So homophobia continues to play a huge role. And, yes, we've come a long way in 27 years. We really have, in terms of talking about our sexuality, gay men coming out of the closet. But still, even here in San Francisco, homophobia plays a major role. And as I suggested in my talk, in the communities at greatest risk, in the black and Hispanic communities, the homophobia is like it was in the white community 40 years ago.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Marcus Conant. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the LGBT forum of the Commonwealth Club and your moderator for tonight's program. We're discussing the future of the AIDS epidemic. Circling back to politics once again, do any of the presidential candidates, in your opinion, have a comprehensive approach to HIV health care and prevention?
Unfortunately, I haven't seen a comprehensive approach on anything from the candidates. We talk about superficial issues, and the press never really gets into asking questions about policy, like how will you get out of Iraq, or how will you take care of the housing crisis, or how will you take care of HIV/AIDS. So no, I've not heard a comprehensive program from any of the three major candidates.
HIV testing currently has a lag time of several months of identifying transmission after actual infection. Are there any improvements in testing in this area?
Yes. If you think you've been exposed, well, first, if you think you've been exposed, you should go on post-exposure prophylaxis. That means that you should take medication that will kill the virus, and we don't know exactly how long you should take it for. We don't know exactly what you should take, but you should take it, and you should see your doctor, and you should start taking it within 72 hours. I often get phone calls from physician friends who say, hey, I stuck my finger with a needle from an HIV-infected patient, and I think I ought to do something. You say, when did it happen? Oh, I've been worried about it. It's about 2 weeks ago. Well, that's too late. You need to do it immediately. But a drug like Atripla, which is a combination of three drugs taken immediately, there's good evidence that post-exposure prophylaxis like that will prevent you acquiring the disease. The trouble with that, of course, is the cost. 10 Atripla pills for 10 days' worth of treatment cost $570. These pills cost $57 a piece. And that's one of the problems, because we could probably cut down on transmission by having pre-exposure prophylaxis. Have every guy who's going out to pick up somebody tonight take a pill before he goes to the bar. The trouble is, at $57 a pill, the society and the individual can't afford it. Now, the other question there was about earlier testing, I think. And yes, there's an answer to that as well. If you think you've been exposed, one, go on post-exposure prophylaxis. But then as soon as appropriate, have a viral load test, because the viral load goes up long before the antibody rise rises. The ELISA test measures the antibody rise, but you can measure a viral load elevation within a week.
You have conducted critical research in the area of medicinal cannabis. Does medical marijuana really work?
Yes.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point of our program where we have time for only one more question. And that would be, what is the most effective and cheapest way to shrink the AIDS epidemic?
In my view, to shrink it in the United States, because the problems in the developing world are quite different from here, but the most effective way to shrink it in the United States would be universal testing. People would be more responsible, we would find out who's positive, and we could get them on treatment.
Our thanks to our speaker, Dr. Marcus Conant, and also to our audience both here and on radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Oh, can I give you the sound this morning? Sure.